From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today we look at corporate welfare, from a congressional push to give broadcasters $40 billion worth of free spectrum to allow them to go digital, to welfare for weapons dealers.
The amazing thing is that although the Cold War is over, we've managed to put U.S. weapons into the middle of practically every conflict on Earth. Now that there's no Soviet Union to have an arms race with, basically the model seems to be sell as much as you can on the world market, and on the other hand come back to the Pentagon and say, we got to build something better. I don't know how these guys got these F-16s, but gee, we better build the F-22.
And in Maine, the IRS is attempting to sell the home of war tax resisters. We'll hear from the family.
If you pay for war, then you're risking the annihilation of the planet. We feel it's less risky to lose our house.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. House Speaker Newt Gingrich said yesterday Bob Dole would bow to the wishes of the majority of delegates to next month's Republican nominating convention and pick an anti-abortion running mate. He was speaking on ABC Television's This Week with David Brinkley. This followed Bob Dole's reversal of his call for a tolerance plank in the Republican platform, which specifically targeted pro-choice Republicans. Bowing to threats by abortion opponents who said they would disrupt his convention in August, Dole reversed himself, saying he would abide by their wishes concerning language in the Republican Party platform. The agreement was worked out with Platform Committee Chair Republican Henry Hyde. It eliminates language from the abortion plank that expressed tolerance for those who favor abortion rights and sprinkles it instead throughout the rest of the platform. Dole said last month he wanted to attach tolerance language only to the abortion plank and said that decision was not negotiable. But it outraged abortion opponents who felt they were being singled out as troublemakers who were liabilities for the party. It remains to be seen what pro-choice Republicans will do. After Newt Gingrich's appearance on This Week with David Brinkley yesterday, he left ABC studios only to be confronted by a group of pro-Medicare activists.
Mr. Gingrich, when are you going to start paying for tax breaks for the rich by cutting Social Security for our senior citizens?
That's not true. What you just said is not true.
You said
no, wait.
That's true.
That's not true.
I've got a mother who's 87 who's very concerned about that. And I'm not having to help her, and I can't afford to do that.
No, and would you, if you'll let me answer you, I have a mother-in-law who is 81. The fact is that we increase Medicare and that we keep Social Security exactly as it is.
While there is a 7% increase in Medicare, Republicans want to scale back its growth to save over $150 million over the next few years. More Dole news. Bob Dole reportedly planned to reverse his position on repealing the federal ban on assault weapons, but backed off under pressure from House Speaker Newt Gingrich and other Republicans. The story appears in the new issue of Time. The magazine reports that Bob Dole was planning to drop his support for a repeal of the assault weapons ban at a campaign appearance in Virginia last Tuesday. The magazine says Gingrich complained, noting that Dole once promised the speaker to make repealing the assault weapons ban a top priority. Dole's substituted language says the issue has moved beyond the debate over banning assault weapons. He instead pressed for a national system of instant computer checks of gun buyers instead of, quote, endlessly debating the merits of gun control legislation. And a leading Republican has some critical words for Bob Dole's campaign. Jack Kemp says he was, as he puts it, frankly disappointed that Dole didn't address the nation's oldest and largest civil rights group last week. Dole's campaign had successfully offered Kemp as a stand-in, but the convention would not accept him. Interviewed on CNN, Kemp disagreed with Dole's suggestion that the NAACP invitation was an attempt to lure him into a hostile reception. Dole said he thought the group's president, Kwesi Mfume, was a liberal Democrat. Kemp, on the other hand, says he believes it was a sincere invitation and that he hopes it's offered again. And Jesse Jackson opened his campaign in Tokyo yesterday against alleged sexual harassment by Japanese companies in the United States by calling on Japan to live up to global standards of behavior. Jackson has been prominent in recent protests against the U.S. subsidiary of Mitsubishi Motor Corporation. He also called on Japan not to accept outdated concepts of behavior as just part of their culture. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has charged Mitsubishi with creating a hostile and abusive work environment at its subsidiary nuclear plant in Illinois. After Tokyo, Jackson visits Indonesia on a similar mission, where he plans to take up allegations of exploitation of workers used to produce low-price goods for the U.S. market. And today in Washington, Global Exchange and Press for Change are holding a news conference in front of a Foot Locker sportswear and footwear store to launch a national campaign to pressure Nike to stop exploiting Indonesian workers. And today, Kathy Lee Gifford is testifying before Congress on child labor. In other corporate news, Thomas Sandifer Jr., a former tobacco executive who testified to Congress in 94 that he did not believe nicotine was addictive, died yesterday following a long illness. Sandifer was among the chief executive officers of the nation's six major cigarette companies who testified before Congress that they did not think nicotine is addictive. They also denied claims that tobacco companies manipulate the amount of nicotine in their brands to hook smokers. A former subordinate of Sandifer disputed his testimony. Jeffrey Wigand, a biochemist and the former head of research at B&W, told the CBS program 60 Minutes that Sandifer lied when he told Congress he believed nicotine was not addictive. And another death this weekend, Carl Schoffler, the former undercover district police officer who arrested the five Watergate burglars in 1972, died of pancreatic cancer. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Last week, a coalition of more than 50 groups gathered at the National Press Club to call on congressional leaders to stop pressuring the Federal Communications Commission to rush ahead with a multi-billion-dollar giveaway of the broadcast spectrum to broadcasters who wish to go digital. The groups were represented by the Media Access Project, the Center for Media Education, and People for the American Way. They say the giveaway is worth at least $40 billion and should be auctioned instead. Before we talk about the spectrum war, we turn to Catherine Montgomery, president of the Center for Media Education, who lays out what $40 billion could buy.
First of all, school lunches. $40 billion would fund 8 years of the National School Lunch Program, which subsidizes lunches to more than half of all American school children. We're giving this away at the end of the session this morning to the highest. No, we're selling it to the highest bidder, actually. That's a good idea. Textbooks. $40 billion would buy every student in the country 24 textbooks a year for 13 years, an entire K through 12 education. This should be essential reading for that. Prenatal care. $40 billion would cover full prenatal care and delivery costs for every baby born in the nation for the next 2 years. Education, particularly education in the state of Mississippi. $40 billion would enable Mississippi to double its education funding for the next 5 years. National parks. $40 billion would eliminate the $4 billion backlog of repairs needed by the national park system, with enough money left over to run all 368 parks until the year 2010. Clean water. $40 billion would ensure safe drinking water. We're showing you what's at stake here. Would ensure safe drinking water throughout the United States for the next 18 years. Taxpayer refund. $40 billion would deliver a check for $343.34 to every taxpaying family in the country. Schools. $40 billion would build 5,882 new elementary schools, replacing those which have deteriorated and making room for an increasing number of incoming students. And finally, $40 billion would wire every public school classroom to the information superhighway and would provide a computer for each group of five students in the country. We think that is a list of very valuable public benefits, and we are going to push very strongly to see that this auction happens.
Catherine Montgomery of the Center for Media Education speaking at the National Press Club, where the coalition of public interest groups blasted the congressional push for what the groups call the $40 billion broadcast spectrum boondoggle. After their news conference, I went over to the Media Access Project and spoke to its deputy director, Gigi Sohn, and asked her to explain just what the debate is all about.
Well, basically, we want to persuade Congress that giving broadcasters multi-billions of dollars worth of public airwaves for absolutely nothing is very bad policy.
What is it that they're doing? What are these airwaves? Who's getting it?
Well, basically, several years ago, the FCC set aside a large allocation of spectrum for broadcasters to provide high-definition television. It's the highest quality digital television. But as technology changed, broadcasters asked for what they call spectrum flexibility, which would permit them to provide one low-quality digital television channel.
Which is what we have now?
No, right now we have what's called analog television. It's lesser quality, but not a whole lot less than this one digital channel would be. But the point is that on the new spectrum, they would be able to provide not only television services, but pay services like data, cellular telephone services, paging services, and they don't want to pay for that, either with money or with public service. This is a battle being waged on two fronts. The first front is at Congress. Now, only Congress can authorize auctions of the spectrum. We believe the spectrum that is now set aside for this digital television should be auctioned and a proceeds set aside for non-commercial telecommunications uses, like public broadcasting and wiring schools and libraries, providing money for community computing centers, non-commercial uses like that. So that's battle number one. Battle number two is being waged at the FCC, because the FCC is considering, they don't have auction authority, but they're considering what terms they should set upon broadcasters if they do decide to give them the spectrum. So some of the terms are, should there be extra enhanced public interest obligations? And we are arguing at the FCC that if you give broadcasters the spectrum and they don't have to pay for it, then you should make them do far more in public service than they're doing right now.
Why should the broadcasters be given anything? I mean, aren't they making money off of everything that they get? Why isn't this being sold to them?
Well, that's my whole point. I mean, I'm arguing that the spectrum should be sold to them. But the problem is that only Congress can make that determination. If Congress chooses to do nothing, then the FCC will probably go ahead and just give them the spectrum.
But I'm trying to think of it in terms of land, for example. If there was public land and developers wanted a bunch of it, is this equivalent to just saying, no, you can have it?
It's exactly what it is. It's exactly what it is. This is giving away very valuable public airwaves, public property that's not unlike giving away public lands. It's a very apt analogy.
And what's the rationale?
The rationale is that broadcasters' rationale is that they serve the public. They do public interest programming. They act as public trustees, and therefore they deserve to get this spectrum.
How do they serve the public? I mean, they don't do very much public interest stuff.
Well, you're not going to get any disagreement there. I mean, they're arguing right now they don't even want to do 3 hours of children's educational and informational programming a week. I mean, their public interest obligations under the current scheme are a joke.
Let me play you the response of the administration when I asked Greg Simon, who is Vice President Gore's telecommunications expert, when I asked at the White House press briefing the question of why they're giving it away.
Senate leaders recently wrote a letter to the FCC calling for the giveaway of the spectrum to broadcasters for digital high-definition TV. This morning there was a press conference of grassroots organizations saying that that should be auctioned, and the proceeds of that should either go to public broadcasting or could be used, for example, $40 billion to build more than 5,800 schools around the country. You're just talking about the auctioning of the channel 60 to 69. What about the auctioning of that full spectrum that's being talked about as a giveaway?
The two points you raised. First, the letter to the FCC suggesting that they give away the digital spectrum. We have opposed the idea of auctioning the digital spectrum, and we have proposed a plan to award, not give away, and there's a difference, the digital spectrum with certain public interest obligations that attach to its use, i.e. children's television, political debate, and other things that are made possible by the abundance of channels that digital television will enjoy. But we have said, because the transition to digital television is so important, both technologically and culturally, that we would award the digital licenses and then require the return of the channels television stations use now by the year 2005 and auction those channels, which, when they're all bundled together, we feel are more valuable than if we were to auction the digital channels today.
It or you're giving it away, you're still not auctioning it. It's worth $40 billion. The broadcasters will profit from this handsomely. Why not auction?
Number one, CBO has never scored it, nor has OMB, to be worth $40 billion. The digital spectrum has been scored at around $12 billion by CBO. A lot of people have said all kinds of numbers. We can't operate on hypotheses like that. Number two, the letter to the FCC that you referred to did not talk about giving back the channel they have now, nor did it talk about attaching any public interest obligations to the digital channels. We do attach public interest obligations and require the return of the analog so that it can be auctioned.
So that's Greg Simon, the telecommunications specialist under Vice President Gore. Is what he's saying true?
Well, he's right on some things and he's wrong on others. I just want to say first that it's the first I've heard the administration talk about imposing enhanced public interest obligations upon broadcasters, and I'd like to see them put their money where their mouth is and send letters to the FCC, send them to the Hill, talking about some of these obligations, because this is the first I've ever heard. He's basically wrong when he talks about the value of the digital spectrum, and he's also wrong when he talks about the auction of the digital spectrum necessarily precluding the auction of the analog spectrum. Yes, CBO has may have valued this as $12 billion, but CBO, so far, every time it's valued spectrum, has valued it way under. Plus,
why would they value it under?
Because you can't tell a valuation of something unless you put it to the market. You can't. Nobody has ever auctioned broadcast spectrum before, so it is almost impossible to value it. CBO valued the spectrum that went for personal communication services for $5 billion. It went for $20 billion. The $40 billion figure came from the median of an FCC's valuation of the spectrum, and I think the FCC knows a little bit more about the value of spectrum than CBO, since it's been auctioning off spectrum for the last 5 years. It valued the spectrum as between $11 and $70 billion. The second point I made was that auctioning off the digital spectrum necessarily precludes one day auctioning off the analog spectrum. The coalition I work with wants to auction off both, and it's entirely possible to do that.
What would it mean if the administration said they would put public interest obligations on anyone who got this spectrum?
Well, it would mean a lot only if they put some real teeth into it. You know, if what they said was, okay, broadcasters, you do 3 hours of children's educational and informational programming a week, which is what they're asking for now on the analog channel, you know, if you do that much, we'll give you the spectrum, that's tantamount to a giveaway. They should be doing that at least now. But if they said you have to reserve, you know, 10% of your spectrum's capacity for children's informational and educational programming, you have to reserve 5 minutes a day for 2 months before an election for access by local, state, and federal candidates, and you had to reserve some capacity on your spectrum for public access, then we can start talking. But if they're just going to give away the store for children's television and a couple minutes here and there for free political debate, I don't think that's good enough.
What is President Clinton's interest in giving away the spectrum?
Well, it's any politician's interest in not upsetting broadcasters. He's running for president. And that's, I guess, is what's been so remarkable about Senator Dole's opposition to the giveaway, is that he's really acting against interest. But Clinton doesn't want to upset the broadcasters. They control, broadcasters control, how often a candidate appears on that screen, and that is critical, and what they look like when they're on that screen. I mean, I think one could argue that the portrayals of Bob Dole on television have not been terrific, and who knows if that's tied into his position on digital spectrum or not.
Why is Bob Dole pushing, auctioning it, selling the spectrum rather than giving it away?
Well, see, although I'm a good old liberal, I think that I think he just thinks it's the right populist thing to do. I mean, granted, he's never had a great relationship with the media. He just beat up on the quote-unquote liberal media a short time ago, so he doesn't have that much to lose. But I think that generally he thinks that it's just really, really wrong to give corporate welfare.
Now, are you saying that you support Bob Dole's position fully, auction off the spectrum?
Well, actually, Senator Dole, pretty much, Senator Dole's also talked about reserving a portion of the proceeds for public broadcasting. So when I heard him say that, I was even more supportive. At first, I thought he just wanted to auction it and put it to deficit reduction. But then he made a speech saying that some of the money should be set aside for public broadcasting, and that I can support.
Now, I noticed this group isn't your typical coalition of progressive organizations. Who are the groups in the coalition?
Well, they really range from, on the right, small business groups, taxpayers groups. There are to the left, there's arts groups, consumer groups, media advocacy groups. There are a handful of civil rights groups, First Amendment groups. So it's really a very far-ranging coalition of different types.
Why the groups like the small business groups? What's their interest here?
Well, their interest is they don't like to see corporate welfare, and they don't like to see large corporations get a huge gift.
For people who are interested in maybe putting in their two cents, what can they do?
Well, you can do what you always do, and that's write to you know, your member of Congress, write to the FCC, or, you know, call one of the organizations like mine that's leading the battle. I mean, we'd love to have more and more grassroots organizations on there. We'd like to see this become a campaign issue. Somebody at the press conference today suggested talking to the Reform Party candidate, and I think Ross Perot or Richard Lamb or whoever runs would be, you know, be very, very open to our position.
And what about the Libertarians and the Green Party, Ralph Nader?
Ralph Nader, I know, is on board. I mean, his one of his organizations has signed on to our position.
And what are you doing now with this coalition of grassroots organizations to get the word out?
Well, we're communicating any way we can. I mean, there is a hope that perhaps we could even get some money to buy some airtime. We're using new technologies, internet, to try to get people interested in this. And we're, you know, the printed press has done a pretty good job of getting this message across. But the problem is people watch television. And because television broadcasters have a huge stake in this matter, they've not done a very good job of covering this issue fairly.
I can't say I heard any of the television broadcasters at the White House press briefing pursuing this issue.
Yeah, exactly.
Of why are you giving us this gift. What is your website and also your phone number if people want to get in touch with the Media Access Project?
Okay, well, our website is www.essential.org and then /map.
For Media Access Project, for people to remember.
And but it's probably better to give a call, 202-232-4300.
One more time.
202-232-4300.
Gigi Sohn, Deputy Director of the Media Access Project. Next up, another form of AFDC, that's Aid for Dependent Corporations, and that is Welfare for Weapons Dealers. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. We'll be right back. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now! Tomorrow, the IRS will try to auction the home and land of private citizens who are war tax resisters. They've refused to pay federal taxes for decades. The IRS tried to sell the home of Elizabeth Gravelos and Arthur Harvey last month, but there were no offers to buy it. It's the first time in 7 years the IRS will try to sell the home of war tax resisters. The main home is in the small town of Hartford. Claire Holman reports.
The farming life usually means getting out of the house early and into the fields. But for pacifists Elizabeth Gravelos and Arthur Harvey, and their two children, Max and Emily, the threat of losing their home in blueberry fields has turned their life upside down. On the scheduled day of the IRS auction last week, the phone rang nonstop.
Oh, no. Hi, Mom. No, we'll call you right after 11 o'clock, when we know.
11 a.m. is the time the IRS is scheduled to open the sealed bids to auction off Elizabeth and Arthur's properties, two woodlots, a 13-acre blueberry field, and their home, a so-called unimproved main farmhouse with no electricity, only one cold water faucet, and an outhouse. Since the family makes its living from selling blueberries and pansies, losing the field and the greenhouses would be a significant loss. For both Arthur and Elizabeth, conscientious objection to paying for weapons in war has deep roots. Besides their farming life, the two have a small side business selling books by and about Mahatma Gandhi. Arthur has not filed a tax return with the IRS since 1959. Elizabeth stopped in 1972 during the Vietnam War.
It's riskier to pay for war than it is to lose your house. And that's our position, that if you pay for war, then you're risking the annihilation of the planet. And we don't want to do that. We feel it's less risky to lose our house.
Their protest is not against paying taxes. In fact, they pay local and state taxes each year, and they are active in their community. Elizabeth is on the local school board and the town recreation committee. Arthur spent 7 years on the town planning board. Over the years, instead of sending money to the Pentagon, they have contributed thousands of would-be federal tax dollars to various low-income housing and peace-promoting organizations. But such efforts do not translate into a reduced debt with the IRS, which claims the family owes $62,000 in taxes and penalties for a six-year period ending in 1992. During that time, the family of four had an income of about $19,000 a year, not far from the poverty line.
Tremble, sick with fear, and hear their death bells ringing, when friends rejoice.
The Gravelos Harvey House sits directly across the street from the town office where the IRS auction took place. The day of the auction, war tax resistors and peace activists from throughout New England and as far away as Chicago gathered to show their support. At a modest war memorial outside the town hall, the group organized a speak out on war tax refusal. Massachusetts resident Bob Beatty is perhaps the only one here who really knows what Elizabeth and Arthur must be feeling today. The last house the IRS seized 7 years ago was the home he was living in.
I was watching the dudes walk in there with the sign a little while ago, and I sort of started to get angry, and I guess what I had to remember is that they're just little clogs in a big machine, and we're little pieces of sand in the big machine. We're irritants, and we're very important irritants, and I take great pride in being an irritant. And on a day like today, I need to remember to be proud of being irritant and not scared of being a little piece of sand.
To demonstrate their commitment to redirecting tax dollars, supporters collected money to help local Hartford families who had liens on their houses because they'd been unable to pay town taxes. Only minutes before the IRS bids were opened, the tax resistors delivered the donation of over $2,000. The town clerk, Kathleen Hutchins, received the money from the group.
This is the amount of checks and cash that will cover all the outstanding tax liens in the town of Hartford for people who
are
on this list. Well, I know. On people's homes who might otherwise lose their homes for non-payment of taxes.
To begin with, we very seldom take people's homes for non-payment of taxes. We usually offer it back to them, and if they can't pay it, we do give them a repurchase mortgage agreement. We've never taken anybody's property in this town for non-payment of taxes.
So today is really a first, so, even though it's not the town of Hartford that's taking it.
Well, that I don't know. I don't know how many other people have been involved in this situation. So, but I will take it and I will receipt it, just like I would anybody else's.
We actually, the amount that I've given you, we have 11 cents change coming.
Okay, I will make out the receipts and give you whatever's coming back to you, plus a copy of all the receipts.
Great, thanks.
Moments later, the IRS bids were unsealed. Onlookers crowded the tiny one-room town office, peering over the high counter as IRS agent Diane Santoros opened the envelopes.
Okay, the sealed bids received as a result of the notice of sale of the property seized from Mr. Harvey and Ms. Gravelos, which was published in the Lewiston Sun Journal, will now be opened. Is anyone here who's made a bid?
Exactly seven bids were made on the Gravelos Harvey property. Outside the town office, over 40 supporters awaited the news. Elizabeth Gravelos spoke first.
Well, the good news is nobody bid on our house.
And so then there's the rest of the news. Someone did buy the blueberry field. And those are the important properties to us. The house is certainly the most important, and we're relieved that no one bid on that.
The bad news is they're having another sale in a month at the IRS office, and they don't know what the minimum bid will be at this time.
Those are the two properties that are essential to our present way of life.
While the results of the sale were mixed, knowing their neighbors had bid against them was painful. One of the successful bids, however, was made by their 20-year-old daughter, Emily. 16-year-old Max, who's not legally old enough to buy property, had asked Emily to bid on his behalf. He gave her his entire savings, $727 earned from raking blueberries for the family business, to buy the small woodlot across the street from their house. Emily's bid beat out one by the town officials, whose children she had played with growing up.
It's been really hard, you know, coming home to see if my house is going to be bought by somebody, but I was really happy that no one bought it. And I was happy that I bought the property in place of my brother, who's not able to bid on it, instead of the selectman who bid on it, because that would have been hard to have the selectman buy it.
It's unclear what lies ahead for the Gravelos Harvey family. The IRS will again try to auction the house on July 16th. Right now, though, the family is just trying to get through this year's blueberry season. The person who bought their blueberry field seems likely to let them lease it, at least for a while, and they can still work two other fields they already rent from local landowners. But even the backbreaking work of cultivating blueberries will not clear their minds of their concern for the future. Both Arthur and Elizabeth hope supporters will urge the IRS, nationally and locally, to call off the sale of the only property they still have left, their home. For Pacifica, this is Claire Holman.
Thank you for that report, Claire. And by the way, the phone number of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee is 1-800-269-7464. That's 1-800-269-7464. And you're listening to Democracy Now! While polls indicate Americans think the military budget is decreasing, in fact, it's increasing. In addition to moral objections of peace activists like Elizabeth Gravelos and Arthur Harvey, the economics of the budget is also a major issue. William Hartung is the director of the Arms Trade Resource Center of the World Policy Institute that's based at the New School for Social Research in New York City. He recently released a report called Welfare for Weapons Dealers: The Hidden Costs of the Arms Trade. Bill, what did you find?
Well, surprisingly enough, last year when they were shutting down the federal government, allegedly because the Republican Congress and President Clinton were going to cut the budget deficit, they were sneaking in all kinds of little goodies for corporations and special interests. And one of the things that I found was that there were two new subsidy programs created to help private companies sell weapons overseas. There was a big arms export loan guarantee fund that could go up to $15 billion in exposure. And there was a new tax break for foreign arms clients, where when they buy U.S. weapons, they don't have to pay the kind of fees they used to reimburse the Treasury for the cost of developing those things. So basically what happened is $7 billion a year in government subsidies for arms sales went up to $7.6 billion. So there was a $600 million increase, a lot of which accrues to companies like Lockheed Martin and McDonnell Douglas, big, very profitable defense contractors that are by no means in need. And this at a time when we're being told there's no money for child nutrition programs, no money for health care. This is how Congress and the president chose to spend our money, and it's really an outrage.
Now, can you explain how it works, how the U.S. government gets involved with private military contractors that are selling weapons abroad?
In effect, the Pentagon acts as an arms brokerage. They have a special division called the Defense Security Assistance Agency. They negotiate arms sales with foreign countries. They let them do test flights. They do promotional activities. They coordinate sending U.S. weapons to international air and trade shows. Sometimes U.S. pilots go and tell stories about how great U.S. weapons are to help close the deal with foreign clients.
Why is the Pentagon doing this?
It comes down to who's making money on it. In Lockheed Martin, the Aerospace Industries Association, the big defense conglomerates have pushed overtime to get these new subsidies. They gave $14 million to members of Congress since 1990 to advance this objective. They've got all kinds of specialized panels where they advise the president and the State Department about how to change arms export regulations to make them more favorable to U.S. companies. So really, in my opinion, it's become sort of a naked special interest program, whereas in the Cold War, perhaps some people bought into some of the logic of it being a defense program. I don't see subsidies for arms sales really serving that purpose anymore.
Who are some of the Congress members who are the top proponents for the military contractors?
Well, one interesting person is Dirk Kempthorne. He's a Republican senator from Idaho. He used to be a vice president for governmental affairs of the FMC Corporation, which, among other things, sells armored personnel carriers to places like Turkey. So he's very familiar with the arms business. He comes from an arms company. When they needed somebody to carry their bill in the Congress, they chose one of their own. But also on the Democratic side of the aisle, you've got Senator Chris Dodd. He's head of the Democratic Party, longstanding Democratic senator. He put in special provisions so that the Export-Import Bank could lend money to Turkey to buy helicopters from Sikorsky Helicopter, because that company builds its helicopters in Connecticut. And he went on the floor of the Senate and bragged about how he had made a difference for workers in Connecticut by getting through these loan guarantees. Of course, he didn't point out how the helicopters were used, primarily to ferry Turkish troops into combat against Kurdish villages in the southeast, where they've destroyed several thousand villages. 19,000 people have been killed in the civil war in Turkey, primarily using U.S. weapons to do so. So when you think about U.S. weapons making a difference, I think that kind of use of U.S. arms to abuse human rights, to kill innocent people, is not worth any amount of money. And what we found, in fact, is even the jobs argument doesn't hold up the way it used to.
Why not?
Well, a lot of these deals are structured now where they have to give some of the production to the overseas client. So, for example, Turkey is building F-16s in a factory in Ankara. They have 2,000 workers on their assembly line there. That's the biggest F-16 production line in the world. It's bigger than the one in Fort Worth, Texas, where Lockheed Martin has its main U.S. plant. And the reason is, going back to the 1970s, every time they sold an F-16, they parceled out a little bit of production, sold off a little bit of technology to entice the foreign country to buy the aircraft. So now you have workers, for example, on strike at McDonnell Douglas because their jobs are being shipped overseas to places like Finland and Switzerland as part of what they call offset arrangements, ways to help foreign arms buyers offset the costs of buying these expensive weapons from the U.S. And the people that pay the price are the workers whose jobs get shipped overseas.
Let's talk a little more about how the U.S. actually uses personnel to be the salespeople for these weapons. You have a chapter in your report on bringing out the big guns, air shows, and advocacy by cabinet members.
Well, this is one of the most amazing things. The first time I witnessed it was at the Paris Air Show, where they had 140 U.S. military personnel there in the summer of 1991, right after the Gulf War. And these guys were literally telling war stories. You know, I flew this helicopter in the Gulf. It's the greatest piece of equipment you could ever want to see. And Bob here from Textron will tell you how much it costs. You know, it was really like a...
And these guys are on salary here for the U.S. government.
On the taxpayer tab, these guys are helping these companies sell their weapons. And the late Ron Brown, one of the things he did was every time he went on an overseas trade mission, he would make pitches for U.S. weaponry. Secretary of Defense Perry did the same at a weapons show in the United Arab Emirates last year. Even President Clinton, he had a meeting at the White House with the Dutch Prime Minister. They were supposed to be talking about Bosnia and the future of NATO. He came out of the lunch meeting, and the first question from the reporters was, "Well, Mr. President, did you convince them to buy the helicopters?" And he had persuaded them to buy Apache attack helicopters from McDonnell Douglas, who later found out that that deal included 150% offsets, which means McDonnell Douglas has promised to generate more business in the Netherlands than they're getting in money for buying those aircraft. So even in the cases where, you know, it goes right up to the president making the sales pitch, it doesn't necessarily end up in a benefit for the U.S. economy.
Isn't it true that they actually pressure these countries to buy these weapons, saying that if you do this, you'll be able to work more closely with our military, or we'll support you more in terms of foreign policy?
There's kind of a notion of, you know, if you buy from us, we will defend you. And that's certainly what Secretary Perry did in the United Arab Emirates. This was in March of 95, he was ringing the alarm bell about the Iranian threat and the Iranian arms buildup. Same time, he was visiting a weapons show in the UAE, and he actually gave a press conference from the deck of a U.S. naval frigate that was parked there for the length of the show, at which he said, well, if you get in a jam with Iran, like your friends in Kuwait got with Iraq, and you want us to come to your defense, it would certainly be much easier to do so if you had one of these U.S. Navy ships like this one, so we could work more closely with your armed forces. And he all but said to them, you know, if you really want us to bail you out in a pinch, you better buy American. It was almost a veiled threat in a sense.
We're talking to William Hartung. He's senior research fellow at the World Policy Institute. His report is called Welfare for Weapons Dealers, The Hidden Costs of the Arms Trade. I was just listening to Senator Spencer Abraham of Michigan, and he was saying that there should be an overall tax cut. He's one of the biggest promoters of overall tax cuts because we are not in a war and we're not in a Cold War. And yet he and other Republicans and Democrats are not saying that the military budget should be cut. So where do you get this tax cut?
Well, the way things are proceeding now, the tax cut's going to come out of the hides of poor and middle-income people because the Pentagon budget is not being touched. In fact, Congress last year spent $7 billion more than the Pentagon asked for. This year, the Republicans in Congress want to tack on $14 billion more than the Pentagon has requested. So unless there's a change on one side of the aisle or the other, there's no savings to be had there. And then in the arms export area, they're also increasing subsidies. So basically, if you're going to leave defense untouched and you're going to cut taxes, that basically leaves domestic programs to take those hits.
How does President Clinton compare to his predecessors when it comes to pushing U.S. weapon sales abroad?
Well, as somebody in the Aerospace Industries Association said, you know, the president's been a friend of ours. He has really promoted arms sales as an economic matter. You know, he wants the United States to be an export superpower, and he doesn't seem to care whether we're selling weapons that kill human beings or refrigerators or cattle. A lot of the Clinton ethos is really an export is an export, and let's close the deal. Let's help the companies make those sales. And I think that's really a tragic miscalculation on his part.
We just recently talked about his pushing these U.S. F-16 sales, their Lockheed Martins, to Indonesia.
And, you know, there's a case where you have a country that for 20 years has been occupying East Timor in violation of international law, has participated in one of the worst proportional genocides in history, has a record of human rights abuse within its own borders. And the Clinton administration is saying, well, you know, under pressure, maybe we won't give them small arms, but we'll sell them some F-16s because you can't really use that to abuse human rights. But, of course, to make that kind of statement to the Indonesian military that, well, yeah, you know, we're getting a little heat, but we're going to sell you F-16s, sends exactly the wrong message. I mean, it's one of the most misguided policies I can imagine.
We talked about President Clinton. What about Bob Dole?
Well, Dole has not spoken frequently to these issues, but he does have some light aircraft manufacturers in Kansas. He has also gone to bat for the industry. He put some money in the defense budget so they could build more cluster bombs at a little ammunition plant in Kansas run by a company called Day and Zimmerman that has contributed to his presidential campaign. I would say he would probably be as pro-export as Clinton. The one area where he's done something positive, he supported in the Senate a limit on the use of landmines by U.S. forces. And that was under pressure from his wife, Elizabeth Dole, because she runs the Red Cross. The Red Cross has seen all the terrible consequences these landmines have for people. So, you know, I would say Dole would lean towards industry. He would not have a policy dramatically different from Clinton's.
And I want to thank you very much for joining us, Bill Hartung. I'm sorry we have to cut this conversation short, but we have to move on with our next segment. Bill Hartung is author of the report Welfare for Weapons Dealers, The Hidden Costs of the Arms Trade. It's put out by the World Policy Institute at the New School for Social Research in New York City. If you'd like to get a copy of that report, you can call 212-229-5808. That's 212-229-5808. And we'll be back with John Pike of the Federation of American Scientists in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington, D.C. Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, joins us in Berkeley. And we're also joined in the studio here in Washington by John Pike, who is with the Federation of American Scientists. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
And hi, Larry.
Hello, Amy.
It's good to be with you. We were just looking at the paper last week, a couple of very interesting stories on the Pentagon. Also, right now, the Senate is taking up the authorization bill for the Pentagon. In the Washington Post last week, there was a story called "The Budget You Can't See. In a Shrinking Defense Pie, the Stealth Slice is Growing Thicker Each Year." What is this black budget that Bill Sweetman is talking about?
Well, Bill Sweetman has done an excellent job over the last decade or so of chronicling all of these secret weapon systems where the normal democratic oversight process simply doesn't function. It's very interesting that Secretary of Defense Perry, back when he was a senior defense official in the Carter administration, started a lot of the stealth weapons that were used during Operation Desert Storm. And Bill Sweetman's analysis of the defense budget over the last couple of years suggests that, once again, the Clinton administration is in the business of starting to build a lot of secret weapons that the taxpayers just don't know about.
You talked about the congressional oversight. Amy just mentioned the congressional oversight process, in which oversight is a double entendre word, I think, in many cases. But in Sweetman's article, he talks about waived programs. That's W-A-I-V-E-D, waived programs, which are not even submitted to any congressional committee. What can you tell us about those?
Well, not very much. They're extremely secret. Basically, these are programs that have been essentially completely excluded from the normal oversight process. Only a few people on the Hill are even made aware of them in general terms. They're certainly not privy to the details of them. And there's a completely separate management and accounting system over at the Pentagon as well, so that all of the checks and balances that are normally put into place to try to make sure that the taxpayers are getting their money's worth simply don't apply here.
So President Clinton's plans to spend two-thirds more on secret research and development than it did under the last budget that George Bush sent to Congress. This is the Air Force. A $2.1 billion increase.
And what's that going for? Well, no one knows. I think that many of the people who over the last week or two have beat me to the movie theater and seen Independence Day may have heard about this facility called Area 51, which is across the street from the Nevada test site. This is a facility where a lot of these secret weapons are developed and tested. I don't think they have anything out there to deal with an alien invasion, but if you want to know where a lot of this black money is going, that's probably where it's going. What it's going for, though, is a different question.
You mentioned Secretary of Defense Perry. Something I had forgotten, if I ever knew it, until I read Bill Sweetman's article, is that Perry had or has a financial interest in an electronic surveillance equipment company called ESL. When he was nominated for Secretary of Defense, he was presented as a Stanford academic, not a businessman who has interests in the very type of thing that he's supposed to be acquiring.
Well, it's not simply Secretary of Defense Perry. It's also Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Paul Kaminsky. It's also the Director of Central Intelligence John Deutsch, and probably half a dozen other senior administration officials that you've never heard of, all of whom are part of a series of interlocking directorates of partnerships of a variety of defense firms. And unlike defense officials in previous administrations, they've been permitted to retain their interest in these companies even while they're serving in office.
Now, wait a minute. Slow down. Do you mean to say that? I'm trying to get my shock-o-meter up here to try to feel shocked about this without sounding hypocritical, because it goes on all the time. But
well, this
really,
is, no, this is different. This is different because normally when somebody goes into the administration, they basically have to divest themselves of interests in businesses that they're going to be making decisions about.
Right.
On the, what's happening here, however, is let's take the probably the most egregious example of it, something that we saw in Bosnia last fall when they were sitting down to draw up the maps to figure out who was going to be occupying what area. You may recall that there was a tremendous amount of press coverage. There's certainly a lot of praise on the government's Defense Mapping Agency website for a little computer product called PowerScene, which is the piece of software that was used to draw all these maps. Well, the one thing that the New York Times and the government websites don't tell you is that PowerScene is a product made by a company owned by the Secretary of Defense and the Director of Central Intelligence. Mm. And so here they are promoting a product made by the bosses of those two agencies.
Why doesn't anybody ever ask them any questions about this?
Well, it's been very interesting. The Washington
media Post, or either media or congressional oversight.
Well, there have been some questions raised about this. The Washington Post did a very large story on this interlocking directorate of about 8 or 10 or so of these business partners. But curiously enough, basically said this is just business as usual, which I guess just goes to confirm Kinsley's rule about Washington scandals, that the scandal is not what's illegal, the scandal's what's legal.
You know, I should say that later this week there's going to be a hearing on John Deutsch's recommendation, or the Intelligence Committee's recommendation, of using journalists and priests in covert operations. This was, I guess, a recommendation of an intelligence board, not the Intelligence Committee. Mm-hmm. So maybe journalists will not dare to, or hope they'll be the first chosen. Who knows? But why don't John Deutsch and Perry fall under the same regulations that any other public official falls under?
Well,
why isn't their stuff put under in a blind trust or something?
Basically because when they came into office, they said would like to hang on to these businesses, and then Secretary of Defense Aspen went along with it, and the Congress went along with it. They simply made a special exception for them.
Well, there was another piece that came out this week. If people could just close their jaws right now, close their mouths. And that is the piece that Tim Weiner wrote, who actually won a Pulitzer Prize a while ago for his covering of the black budget. A piece he wrote on what happened with the so-called smart missiles and the Persian Gulf War, and the fact that the Pentagon actually lied about their accuracy. Can you talk a little more about that? Of course, we knew a lot of this at the time, but what more has been learned?
Well, I mean, there's really nothing new about this because warfare is really no different from hunting or going fishing. I mean, if you go back and look in World War II, I mean, the American Navy claimed to have sunk the Japanese Navy about three times over. So it should come as no surprise that there would be exaggerated claims for how well weapons worked. What the General Accounting Office, the government accounting agency, found was that in going back and looking at these claims, that they were clearly vastly exaggerated at the time. Subsequent studies probably overplayed their effectiveness. And going back and looking at all of the test data shows that a lot of these weapons were not nearly as effective as originally claimed. Clearly, the most egregious example of that was the Patriot anti-missile system. President Bush at the time claimed that it worked about 98% of the time. Subsequently, the Army determined that it worked only about 60% of the time. And an independent investigation by some folks in Israel and Ted Postol, a professor at MIT, concluded that it may have failed completely over Israel. So a lot of these things that looked really good on TV turned out to be not much more than very expensive special effects.
You say there's nothing new in this report, but I found something startlingly new, at least in the Sunday version of it, where he wrapped up the conclusions of the week, Tim Weiner. The last two paragraphs, this is why I always teach my journalism students, you have to read all of these articles, not just the first few paragraphs. He says that the General Accounting Office's version of this would be impossible in the future, the analysis, because the Program Evaluation Division of the General Accounting Office is being dismantled by the Republican Congress. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the General Accounting Office is a very interesting agency. It started out as basically just being the agency that added up all the receipts and made sure that the numbers added up. In the 1960s, it added an additional division that enabled it to go in and not simply add up all the numbers, but to evaluate these programs. And frankly, over the last 10 or 15 years, I think that the General Accounting Office has been the single best source of information about government programs, what works, what doesn't, what we should be doing, and what we shouldn't be doing. And basically, I think that the Republicans in the Congress have decided that the General Accounting Office was coming up with the wrong answer too often. And so just as they shut down the Office of Technology Assessment last year, which had been critical of some of their pet rocks, they're trying to shut down the General Accounting Office. And basically what you see is this very consistent pattern between black budget items, between waived programs, between all the stuff that's going on out at Area 51, shutting down the Office of Technology Assessment last year and trying to seriously cut back the General Accounting Office this year. It's basically a process whereby these folks don't want you to know where your money's getting off to.
Is this a done deal? Is there anyone in the Clinton administration who's fighting the shutting down of the Program Evaluation Division?
Well, unlike the Office of Technology Assessment, which was a small agency, the General Accounting Office is a much larger agency, has fortunately more friends on the Hill, and I'm hopeful that they're going to be able to avoid the fate of the Office of Technology Assessment. In either event, I'm afraid that they're going to have their wings clipped and not going to be as useful in the future.
John Pike, we only have a few minutes, but we did want to touch on the whole controversy between Dole and Clinton on Star Wars, and has that entered the Senate?
Well, basically, the Senate, either this week or next week, it's always hard to tell with the world's greatest deliberative body exactly when they're going to act on it, is going to have a vote on Bob Dole's Defend America Act, and is also going to have a vote on a somewhat weaker version of that offered by Senator Sam Nunn. Bob Dole has been trying to make Star Wars an election issue, claiming that Bill Clinton is against defending America. Unfortunately, the Clinton administration has really been continuing most of the Star Wars programs that the Bush and Reagan administration initiated, and so Dole's had a real hard time making a campaign issue out of this.
And yet he has.
Well, I think that they figured that they're looking for a foreign policy issue and that this is the best one that they've been able to come up with. I think that between the Clinton administration being so strongly in favor of Star Wars, that Dole has been led into some pretty bizarre things like space lasers that even Republicans have a hard time swallowing. And the bottom line is that I think that the American public recognizes that of all of the problems facing the country today, the odds that somebody is going to launch a missile at us are just not very close to the top of the list.
But he was saying exactly that when he was out here in California a couple of weeks ago. I saw him in three different speeches mention the fact that the Chinese, according to him, had threatened to unleash a missile on Los Angeles. He cited this specifically. I hadn't heard of that threat before. And he said that nothing could stop it except if we built Star Wars.
Well, the thing that's obviously stopping it is that America and China do tens of billions of dollars a year in business, and that launching a nuclear attack on Los Angeles, and we would respond by launching a nuclear attack on Beijing, would be bad for business, and no one's going to do that.
John Pike, what else should we look for as the Senate looks at authorization, what they're going to do for the Pentagon, and what can activists do?
Well, I think that the main issue right now, unfortunately, is just the Star Wars business. The Republicans in the Congress have added something like $13 billion to the defense budget, as much as they've taken out of all of the rest of the defense budget for domestic programs. Clinton administration looks like it's going to be going along with that. The main controversy right now remains Star Wars.
Well, John Pike, we want to thank you very much for joining us. If people want to see what the Federation of American Scientists is doing, do you have a website, phone number?
We sure do, FAS.org, www.fas.org.
Oh, that's easy to remember. And Larry, thanks very much for joining us at this early hour for you out in California.
Talk to you again soon.
Yeah. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Erica Martinez and Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Our director is Bill Wax. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to leave a comment, you can call 1-202-588-0988, extension 313. That's 1-202-588-0988, extension 313. Tomorrow is the Sweatshop Summit, and we'll be having a debate on corporations. Are they the heroic enterprise? Well, you'll see. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now!